Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is attorney David Dow. As a capital crimes appellate specialist in Texas, he's witnessed many of his clients' deaths over the years. And as the founder of the Texas Innocence Network and through his death penalty clinic at the University of Houston Law Center, he's been a part of over 100 appeals, most of which end unsuccessfully. But the deaths of a beloved father-in-law, a client, and the family dog Winona had a profound effect on him. In fact, he writes about it in his new book, Things I've Learned About Dying, a book about life. Dow looks at the question so many of us avoid asking. Is it preferable to anticipate death, prepare for it, and bid family and friends goodbye? Or to fight death to the last breath of being? Or to go suddenly and quietly with no warning? David Dow is the Cullen Professor at the University of Houston Law Center. He's also a visiting professor of history at Rice University. His most recent book prior to this one, The Autobiography of an Execution, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award and won the 2010 Barnes & Noble Discover Award for nonfiction. He's written 5 books in all, more than 100 scholarly articles and essays, and his work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Christian Science Monitor, the Progressive, the Huffington Post, the Nation, and many, many more. David Dow is our guest today on Studio Tulsa. David Dow, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
You're very welcome. I'm happy to be talking to you again.
This book, Things I've Learned From Dying, is a tremendously moving book, and you interweave 3 stories of death. One, a beloved father-in-law who was a person who seemed like he lived life to his fullest each and every day. Eddie Waterman, a client who was on death row for committing and being a part of a heinous crime. And then the death of your family dog, which the combination of these 3 events were pretty tough for you and your family.
They were. They were extremely hard to deal with. I obviously had dealt with the death of lots and lots of clients before. I've been doing this for 20 years, and if you're a death penalty lawyer in Texas who's been doing the job for 20 years, you've had lots and lots of clients get executed, no matter how much success you might also have had. And so I was much more prepared for the death of my client, which is, as you mentioned, one of the 3 stories that I weave together in the book, than I was for either of the other 2. My father-in-law was only 58 years old when he was diagnosed with melanoma, and he was barely 60 when it killed him. And 60 is awfully young, and particularly in his case, he was extremely robust. He was a really accomplished outdoorsman. He's one of these guys who was hiking across Nepal and Bhutan 35, 40 years ago before people were really doing that, certainly back in the day when you had to know what you were doing, because there was not any helicopter that was going to come rescue you if you made a wrong turn and got lost. And I think that when I was looking at this young man who was so vibrant, so alive, and watched him decay, that had an impact on me that was not only unexpected for me, but something I hadn't gone through with any of my clients, even though I'd seen lots and lots of very young men be executed. And then the final story, as you mentioned, that I weave together is the story of our family dog. I've been a dog person my whole adult life, and anybody who has pets, whether it's dog, cats, what have you, has probably had to euthanize or will have to euthanize a pet because we live longer than they do. And so at that level, the fact that we were ultimately forced to euthanize our dog, whose name was Winona, by the way, was not entirely unexpected, but the time that we had to do it came as a complete and total surprise, because she went from being perfectly healthy one day to being literally at death's door the next. She developed acute liver failure. And so both of those other 2 stories, the story of my father-in-law and the story of our family pet, are stories that involved death in the same way that my client's story involved death, but they touched really different emotions in me and prompted a different type of reflection.
Now, I would think one of the things you have to do as a death penalty attorney and a death appeal lawyer is you have to compartmentalize. There's a place where your clients can get to, but there are places where the client cannot get to in order to do your job effectively, to put emotions aside, to be the best rational thinking person to try to figure out the most creative way to save that person's life.
I think that's right. I think that when a lawyer is representing a client who's facing death, it's an important skill to be able to have some emotional distance between the lawyer and the client. You have to make decisions that are strategy-based or tactically-based decisions that having a real substantial emotional involvement with the client can, I think, interfere with. Now, that's not to say that there isn't a whole lot of emotion that's involved in representing somebody who's facing death, not only because, of course, you are literally walking with somebody to the execution chamber, but also because most people on death row have families themselves. They've got moms or dads. They've got brothers or sisters. Many of them have sons or daughters or spouses or significant others. And so those are also people who the lawyers are in touch with, particularly as the execution date draws near. So at least speaking for myself, I wouldn't say that there is a Chinese wall between emotion and reason when you're representing a death row inmate. But the emotion is not so much personal emotion as it is being sensitive to what other people are going through emotionally. And that's something that doesn't translate into dealing with death and dying when it's under your own roof.
And of course, one of the moving parts of this book is to hear your father-in-law talk about his reaction to this diagnosis. In many ways, it reflects that compartmentalizing that a lawyer will do with his client in such a dire situation. He was very, very matter-of-fact and says, okay, I've weighed the options. I think this is probably not going to end well. And he, of course, there the conflict is between the family that wants him to take every action to save his life. And at the beginning of the book, he is saying, well, this is it. And I want to live my last days the way I would like to live them. And it was a very interesting reaction. There's sort of similarities between a lot of the roles of the three stories in this book.
Yes, I think that you've put your finger on something that, at least to me, was really important, something that I very much wanted to write about. And that is that my father-in-law, in addition to being, as I mentioned a moment ago, a really accomplished and vigorous outdoorsman, was also a person of the mind. He was an intellectual. He was a PhD in chemistry. He spent a great part of his professional career as a laboratory chemist, and then he spent the next part of his professional career supervising other laboratory chemists. And when he received this diagnosis, which was a dire diagnosis, I think that his immediate reaction was to think that no matter how long he lived with that cancer, he was not going to be able to do the two things that he most wanted to do, which were to continue to live inside his head as an intellectual, because he recognized that the cancer could metastasize to his brain and rob him of his brain, which ultimately it did.
Yes.
And he also recognized he wasn't going to be able to continue hiking and kayaking and windsurfing and sailing and doing all of the things outdoors that he thought. And so his reaction, therefore, in the face of that diagnosis was, maybe I just shouldn't struggle against this. Maybe what I should do is just go out west and climb a mountain and die doing what I love doing rather than turn to every type of exotic therapy. And what was ironic about it, and I'm not quite sure ironic is the right word, but certainly notable, is that whereas my father-in-law was not at all sure that he wanted to continue pressing on, the client, who I write about in the book, desperately wanted to live longer. And upon reflecting, I thought that one of the reasons that explained that mirror image reaction, and one of the issues, obviously, that I wanted to write about, was that my father-in-law had a wonderful relationship with his wife, wonderful relationship with his two children, a son and a daughter, his daughter being, of course, my wife. And I think that when my father-in-law reflected on all of those relationships, he felt satisfied and fulfilled with them. Obviously, he would like to have been able to have lived longer, but he didn't have any regret about any of those three principal relationships in his life. Whereas my client also had a daughter, but a daughter from whom he had been estranged for many years. And he really wanted to stay alive long enough to be able to reconnect with her, to be able to reestablish a relationship with her, to be able to apologize to her for not having been a good father to her. And I think that part of what drove his desire to hang on, even though he would have been living in terrible conditions, the conditions on death row in Texas, as in Oklahoma, as in most states, are not at all pleasant circumstances under which to live, but he wanted to continue living even under those circumstances so that he could have the opportunity to repair the relationship with his daughter. I think that he felt unfulfilled in the exact same way that my father-in-law felt entirely fulfilled.
And of course, as you learn more about this client through the course of your appeals, you learn that not only in that regret of not knowing his daughter, but his life was scarred from an incredibly young age. His mother had some sort of mental illness, and of course one of his earliest memories was being chased around the house by his mother with a butcher knife and hiding and locking himself in a bathroom till the police came.
Yes, that's exactly right. His mother was diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic. She spent a fair amount of time in mental institutions, and then she was finally taken off to a mental institution for good when she tried to murder her son, who was my client. He was 5 years old at the time that happened and remembered it even 25 years later as if it had just happened that morning. And of course, it's true for many, many of the people who I represent, including this client in particular, that they have experienced things in their lives that are literally unimaginable to people like me. I grew up in a comfortable middle-class household with four younger brothers and two parents who loved all of their kids very much and thought their kids could do no wrong. And to imagine growing up with a father who is completely indifferent to me, with a mother who had a disease that resulted in all types of bizarre behavior, but including a behavior where she tried to kill me, is something that just doesn't process in my brain. But that was what this client of mine experienced. Now, I talk about that in the book not to excuse what he did. And in fact, my client was very insistent in saying that nothing that had happened to him excused anything that he ever did. But I think that if we want to try to understand how it is that people who come into the world exactly the same way that you and I and your listeners do can turn out to be people who would do something that you or I or your listeners would never do, it helps to understand the circumstances that they confronted that thankfully we didn't. And so, yes, that's absolutely one of the things that I write about in the book.
There's essay-like portions in the course of the book, and there's one pretty early in the book which talks about how people think death row inmates find religion because of their proximity to their death. And you have this wonderful, very short essay which sort of talks about what it's like to be a death row inmate or even life without parole in many states where you're in a very small box. I guess in Texas, there's two radio stations. They're both Christian radio stations. Visits from chaplains are maybe their only visits of the day. They have nothing to read, nothing to do. They have nothing but their entire life to reflect on what happened and how they screwed up their lives. It was a very powerful little essay.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I wrote it because there are a number of misconceptions that people have about both the people on death row and the conditions on death row. And one of the things that I hear a lot from people when I tell them about how remorseful my typical client is, and my typical clients are extremely remorseful. And one of the things that I hear from people when I tell them that is they say, well, they're getting ready to be executed. Of course they're remorseful. And what I try to explain to them and what I tried to capture in those sections in the book that you're referring to is that they are remorseful, but it's not because they fear death. It's not because they're close to death. In fact, for many of these guys, they want to hurry up and be executed because the conditions under which they're living are so unappealing. The reason that they're remorseful is precisely because, as you point out, they have 23 hours a day in a 58-square-foot box with literally no human contact. They don't have any contact with other human beings other than guards. They don't have televisions. They don't have computers. They get a couple of radio stations. They're not terribly literate. Most of them are not terribly literate, so they couldn't occupy themselves all day reading, even if they wanted to. So if you've got that many hours in a day and you don't have any entertainment and you subtract the time that you sleep, what you're left with is a whole lot of time, 10 hours, 12 hours, 14 hours, 16 hours, where you have nothing to do except for think. And inevitably, what these guys find themselves thinking about is all of the terrible things that they've done that they wish they could undo, all of the things that they regret. And I think the reason that it is so common for death row inmates to have remorse is because once they are on death row, it is the first time ever in their lives that they have been forced to confront what they've done, that they've been forced to think about the pain that they've caused to themselves, to their own families, to the families of innocent victims. And when they are forced to confront that, they're human beings, after all, and they develop remorse. I think that's what happens. And it's such a common reaction, it's such a common development, that I feel very confident that it is the simple fact that they can't escape thinking about what they have done that makes most of these guys so remorseful.
My guest today is David Dow, professor of law at the University of Houston Law Center. He founded the Texas Innocence Project and is a specialist on death penalty law. And he's the author of a couple of books. His last book was an amazing book, Autobiography of an Execution. His latest book is Things I've Learned from Dying, a book about life. It's published by 12. Getting back to your father-in-law, who I was wondering, did he keep a journal during this? Because there are parts of the book that are italicized as if it's his voice, and I'm wondering if that is your extrapolation of his voice, or these were things he told you, or was this a journal he actually kept?
It was not a journal he actually kept. They were actually notes that I was keeping while he was either undergoing therapy or making decisions what therapy to undergo. And I kept a pretty detailed journal as he was going through all that. I think Henry James says somewhere that if you have to take notes about how something has affected you, it means that it really hasn't affected you. And I've always been fond of that quote. I think that it's generally true. But the reason I was having to write things down is because a lot of his and my conversations while he was undergoing this ordeal had to do with things like what available therapies there were and what therapies he was inclined to pursue and what therapies he didn't want to pursue because he knew what the side effects were and so on and so forth. And so I felt like I just needed to write those things down because I wasn't going to remember them.
Well, the things he would talk to you about this was really, really quite amazing. He did have this idea that perhaps the best thing was not to fight this. And, of course, this is one of the I think a lot of families face this, is whether to fight a really bad diagnosis or not. And I think you allude to experiences with friends having breast cancer, and I think this was a very different case in his case.
I think that's right. I think that there are these three different stories in the book, obviously, and I think that one of them is a story that most readers will not have a whole lot of personal experience with, at least I hope they don't, and that's obviously the story that deals with murder and execution. I hope that not many readers have firsthand experience with murder. I doubt that many readers have firsthand experience with representing somebody who's on death row, but I think that lots of readers, as you suggest, have experience with either cancer or some other fatal, debilitating disease, whether it's themselves, whether it's a loved one, whether it's a close friend, whether it's somebody that they know. And so I think that the questions that my father-in-law confronted, questions about the trade-offs involved, is it worth spending a week hooked up to IV lines where you're getting chemotherapy, which is basically poison, in exchange for buying an extra month or buying an extra 3 months or maybe only buying an extra couple of weeks? Those are calculations that people facing terminal diseases make. And one of the difficulties in the story that I write about is that the decisions that my father-in-law thought were best for him were not necessarily the decisions that were best for his wife and his daughter, my wife. They wanted him to stick around for as long as possible. They wanted him to stick around even if he couldn't sail, even if he couldn't windsurf, even if he couldn't hike, because they just liked being with him. And for him, that wasn't so clear of a choice.
And yet he did follow through with a lot of the treatments.
He did. I think that he never did it happily, but I think that he at least ultimately recognized that their desire to have him in their lives was so powerful that it was worth suffering what, from his point of view, was going to be a very different life from the one that he had imagined. This is a man who had planned 20 years of retirement in meticulous detail. He had lists of all of the rivers he wanted to travel down. He had lists of all of the mountains he wanted to climb. He had lists of all of the places that he wanted to go camp and sleep under the stars. And all of those plans were plans that he was not going to be able to accomplish, and he knew that. And it took him a very long time, I think, to come around to the idea that even though he wouldn't be able to pursue any of those things, it was still worth hanging on because there was that much love that his wife and his daughter and his son had for him.
I was struck, getting back to the similarities between these stories, you know, there's a Texas judge can hand down the death sentence, so can an oncologist. And the families surrounding the person who's been handed a death sentence from an oncologist to a death sentence from a person who's committed a terrible crime, the family reactions are much the same. It's the same sort of grieving process, pre-grieving, if you will.
They are very much the same, and I don't want to suggest moral equivalence, and I think that I'm pretty clear in the book about not suggesting moral equivalence. And yet, as you mentioned, in terms of the human dynamic that is involved, they are very much the same. They are maybe exactly the same. When a client of mine walks into the courtroom and the judge says to the client, "You are going to die on X date," when the client walks out of the courtroom, he is a very different person from the person who walks in. He now knows not only that the fuse is burning, but when it is going to explode. And the family members of my client know exactly the same thing. And there's therefore this pressure on their relationships that is different at the moment that my client walks out of the courtroom as compared to the moment when he walked in. And similarly with my father-in-law, he walks into an oncologist's office and the date of his death is not as precise as the date of my client's death, but it is still reasonably precise. The oncologist says, "I don't know if you're going to die in 1 month or 2 months or 3 months, but it's going to be between 30 and 90 days. And so he doesn't get to circle a date on a calendar, but he does get to put a couple of brackets on a calendar. And when he walks out of the oncologist's office, he has that knowledge, and his family has that knowledge, and their relationship also changes as a result of that diagnosis, as a result of that awareness of the death sentence. And so, yes, I think that those dynamics are very similar. Now, there are obviously differences. There are differences that everybody recognizes. My client put himself in that position because of what he did, and my father-in-law didn't. My father-in-law was dealt a bad hand by fate. Our dog, who I write about, did not do anything to deserve the acute liver failure that she suffered. Putting to the side those differences, and I don't mean to minimize them or to suggest that they're unimportant, but putting them to the side, the dynamic that happens inside the family is very similar in all of those cases.
We really haven't talked about that third story, the Winona, your family dog, who was sounds like a wonderful dog, a great protector of your son. And that was some of the most heart-rending sections. Probably were the most difficult to write. You know, I mean, it's seems to me it would have been incredibly difficult to write about.
You're very perceptive. Those were the hardest pages for me to write. They're the hardest pages for me to edit. They're the hardest pages for me to talk about, honestly. One person who I was talking to said that she thought that I spent fewer pages in the book talking about Winona, that's the dog, than I did either my father-in-law or my client, but she said that she felt like there was way more emotion in those pages, and I think that that's probably right. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that we had the least amount of time to prepare for Winona's death, because even though she was comparatively old for a Doberman, she was 13 when she died. As I said earlier, she went from being perfectly healthy and running up and down the beach one day to being essentially vegetative the next because of this liver failure. So that was one difference. The second difference, of course, is that as any pet owner will know, it's the human beings who make the decisions. In my client's case, I was trying to push off death as long as I could, but I wasn't responsible for imposing it. And in my father-in-law's case, I was consulting with him about what therapies to pursue, but they were ultimately his decision. In the case of our pet, the decisions belonged to my wife and me, and that makes a big difference. And finally, I think, of course, the added aspect of the story about Winona in the book is that our son was part of that story, too. Winona was 5 years old when our son came home from the hospital, so she had been in his life every single day of his life, and the dog ultimately died when our son was 8. He's 13 now, so this happened 5 years ago. And it's a cliche, but it's true when parents say that they are never any happier than their least happy child. And our son was devastated by Winona's death. And at some level, I was surprised by that, I think, by the intensity of his reaction, because he is somebody who had been around death for his whole life, because he knows what his dad does for a living, and he's always known what I do for a living, and my wife and I have talked about it with him since he was old enough to understand. But understanding death in the intellectual or abstract way that a 6, 7, 8-year-old kid understands it is really different from having a living being that you have loved here one day and gone tomorrow. And so that aspect of the story, too, was very difficult for me to relive, and therefore difficult for me to write about. But I think that it's an important part of the story, in part just because it was happening in my life at the time that these events were, but also in part because I think that that's a part of the story that many, many, many people can relate to on a very emotional and visceral level.
I think that is the big takeaway from this book. As a matter of fact, that, you know, in our society, death is related to the abstract. Even when it's a close family relationship, it's not something we live with as previous generations did. And when that comes home, it shows you the power of life, really.
It does show you the power of life, and I'm glad you use that phrase too, because as you mentioned, the book is called Things I've Learned from Dying, but the subtitle is A Book About Life. I wish I could take credit for the subtitle, but I didn't think of it. The publisher did. And when the publisher called me and said, you know, we've been thinking here that we should have this subtitle, A Book About Life, but do you think that's too cheesy? And I said, God, I don't think that's too cheesy. In fact, I wish I had thought of it myself, because that's really true. There are very sad parts of this book, I think. But what the book is really about, at least from my point of view, are the lessons that we get from how we should live our own lives, lessons that we learn because of our proximity to death. And it's a proximity, as you mentioned, that is very different today from what it has been at other points in human history.
No. David Dow, it's a pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us.
You're very welcome. I really enjoyed talking to you very much. Thanks for having me.
David Dow is the Cullen Professor at the University of Houston Law Center and the founder of the Texas Innocence Network. His new book is titled Things I've Learned from Dying, A Book About Life. It's published by 12. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just look for Studio Tulsa and you can search through our archives. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.